because they were so low, the rates were...
Appraise the court ruling. So
0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after. Ooh, boy. That's really hot. And I'm assuming that you see that as well. How about that, Gil? Is that better?
Yes, I've leveled it out.
Okay. Because on my end, it's all red over here on this end. So we'll just fake it and pretend like we really know what we're doing. Nevertheless, the time is 5 minutes after 10, and for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about car repair or car stuff. And you're welcome to join us anytime you want. And the phone number is easy, 602-508-0960. Sitting with me today is Eddie Caruso. Eddie's been with me almost as long as I've been married. Well, a little less long.
A little less. 33 years.
Eddie handles a lot of the vintage car repairs and maintenance. And I think you're putting an electric steering on what?
Actually, it's he wanted electric steering. It's a 1946 Ford two-door coupe.
Okay.
But the issue was, even if we put electric steering on it, he would still be six turns lock to lock. So it'd be easy to steer, but his arms would be tired pulling in and out of the parking lot.
That's three turns for the right turn.
Right.
A hard right turn and three turns for the left turn.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is, we're almost done with it now, is we put hydraulic power steering on it. So the box we have now is four turns lock to lock. And we're going to mount a power steering pump on it, the box. Do some modifications to the steering shaft to adapt it to the new box.
Okay. So the steering wheel is going to be the same. All but the end of the steering shaft is going to be the same. Then you're going to modify that to a steering box that's controlled hydraulically by a power steering pump run on a belt.
Right, driven by a belt.
Okay. All righty. And so far, so good.
Yes, it's actually come together a little bit easier than I anticipated, which is wonderful.
Does that happen a lot to you?
No. No. You know.
Well, what were some of the other... give me another example of something that you've done. Didn't you put fuel injection on something not so long ago?
Yes. The last one I did was a 1955 Bel Air. Took a carburetor system off it and put a fuel injection system on it.
And it was a port fuel or throttle body?
It's a throttle body, so it's... four-barrel throttle-body fuel injection.
Okay. And, folks, the difference is port fuel means that you have an injector for every one of the eight cylinders. A throttle body is like a carburetor on top of the intake manifold that supplies air and fuel to all the cylinders.
But a highly educated carburetor.
No, you're right. No, you're right. Highly, but not nearly as educated as port fuel.
Right.
Because port fuel, we can spray a cylinder at high RPMs. We can give it a bath, or we can just wet it, or we can flood it, right?
Right, yeah. We're not on the throttle body, we're not serving each individual cylinder or intake runner.
It's kind of like whatever's there when the intake valves open, that's the gulp of air and fuel it gets.
Yep.
That's it. With port fuel, we can open or close the valve for fuel.
Correct.
And we can make it go faster, but we can't make it go to where it fogs the neighborhood and your eyes water and all that other kind of stuff.
Well, that's when there's a malfunction.
yeah, like the fuel pressure regulator goes bad and we
Correct.
Start drawing big-time fuel into it. The fuel pressure regulator is just a vacuum-operated device, vacuum from the motor, that keeps the fuel pressure somewhere, I'm going to guess, 35 to 40 pounds?
Normally, yeah, around that range.
All right. And so when you dump the throttle, the vacuum goes away, so the fuel pressure regulator, because it's run by vacuum, the fuel regulator has to compensate for that. So basically what we're trying to do is give you a steady fuel pressure, whether you're idling at the traffic light or whether you're running wide open throttle on your way to Payson.
That's correct.
One way or the other. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Action Auto Repair. Tom has been a friend of mine since 1983. That's when he opened up his repair shop in North Phoenix. Actually, I knew him before that a couple years because he worked for John Rang and sold big engine analyzers, so we had a lot of conversations about that. Nevertheless, he's at I-17 in Deer Valley, the northwest corner, family-owned and family-controlled and family-run auto repair shop that's been around, like I said, since 1983. So if you're interested in technicians that have ASE Master certification and have a lot of experience and aren't going to spend a whole lot of money chasing a very simple problem that they've seen as a senior, you know, two or three times or 2,000 or 3,000 times, then Action Auto Repair at I-17 in Deer Valley is a great place to go. You know, my week has just been really tough. And I lost my keys on Warner Road.
I saw that on the F book.
Yeah. I thought if anybody was going to found a set of keys, then it would be one of those things where it was, they'd Google lost keys, Warner Road, Mesa, Tempe, Chandler. And I kind of created that way, thinking that if that happened, no such luck. To be honest with you, there's about three places I could have lost them. And so the family's out, as we're sitting here doing radio.
Scavenger hunt.
They're out looking, when they got all the grandkids, and we're looking at places that I went.
And there's a reward, right?
Oh, yeah. At least $150 reward, because that's what it's going to cost to replace all the keys.
Right.
So, and the keys are not high security keys, but there's also alarm systems. So if you find the keys and you know that they're mine, it's not going to do you any good. It's not even going to open up our house, because we have an alarm system on our house. So that's not going to do you any good. But anyway, it's going to cost that much to replace them. So that's kind of what we're talking about. Warner between Arizona Avenue and I-10, the westbound lanes. Warner between Arizona Avenue and I-10. So that's all the way from Arizona Avenue all the way across the 101. That's through Chandler. And then from the 101 all the way west to the I-10, which is Ahwatukee. And then I headed south on Priest, actually. And then went over there to pick up drop a trailer off so they could load some more hay on it for me. My horses have decided that they want more hay. That isn't going to work for them. Anyway, we've also, did you have anything that really got you? Oh, we had an inspection this week on a car that had been involved in a crash, and it was one of those, and it wasn't contentious at all. I thought it was really nice. Everybody treated one another with respect. The law enforcement group was there, and their job is to maintain the integrity of the car, because the car has been seized as evidence. And then we have the defense experts and the defense engineers and the defense mechanical guys that are looking at the car to see if there's anything wrong that would have contributed to the accident. Right?
Correct. That's their job.
It is their job.
I mean, for lack of a better synopsis, they're looking for an out.
And they would say, I would agree, they would say, you know, we don't know if the steering came apart. We don't know if we stripped the splines on the gearbox. We don't know if we had an intermittent power steering problem until we look and see. And so, and there's merit to that, because I have also stepped on that side as well. Take a look at this inspection. See if there's anything that would have contributed to the fact that the throttle was wide open and he was doing 118 miles an hour. Yeah, okay. I'll do my best, but don't hold your breath. Right. But I do remember one case where we did have a throttle wide open. We did have a throttle wide open. And it was as obvious to everybody and the entire group of experts just were in awe. It was the one in Payson.
That escape.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
Everybody was real suspicious, and the two sides weren't even talking to one another and all that other kind of stuff. But by the time we got done, everybody knew the truth. That throttle was stuck wide open, and it had nothing to do with the driver. It had nothing to do with anything. It turned out in that particular case to be the car had been in for a recall, and the recall had been done improperly. And because the recall had not been done step by step properly, then there was a kink in the throttle cable for the transmission. And wide open throttle, it allowed that to drop down and lock. And then that held the throttle blades open. And the driver of that car didn't have a chance. The unfortunate part about it, folks, is learn from this. If you have a problem with your throttle and you think the throttle is stuck, then just throw it in a neutral. Every motor in the last 20 or 30 years
Has a rev limiter.
It's not going to blow up the motor. It may sound like it's going to, but it's not going to. But when you throw it into neutral, you still have power brakes, you still have power steering, you still have a horn, you still got all that stuff, and your airbag is still alive, and your airbag's going to sit there and wait to see what happens. But you don't have any problem. Just throw it into neutral, and then just pull off to the side of the road with your brakes. In this particular case, we're not even sure the brakes would have worked at that point, because she had been under wide open throttle for so long. And as a result of that, we knew the brakes were cooked later in an examination. She didn't have a chance.
Right, and wide open throttle, there's so much inertia with the vehicle, it's hard for the brakes to overcome that.
And she was going uphill, but at the same time it was just a terrible thing that happened. The only thing in hindsight, and I think everybody learned from this, was if you have contact or communication with someone and a driver or whatever, is the neutral. Throw it in the neutral. Just throw it in the neutral and just pull off to the side of the road. And when you get to the stop, then turn the key off and we're done. So if that's that's a throttle stick, whether it's an electronic problem, whether you sucked a bird into the throttle blades, and that wouldn't really do it either, because once you let go of your foot, it's going to shut the fuel off.
Right.
It's going to shut the major fuel off. So you can go through a lot of hypotheses, but just throw it in the neutral, and it's going to be, the motor's going to be screaming. Nobody cares. Pull off to the side of the road carefully, slowly, and shut the key off, and it should die.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's worst case, it's better to waste an engine than waste your life.
Yeah, and even if the motor blows up when it's running wide open like that, you're still going to have one, two, or three applications of your power brakes. Your power steering is going to go away, but you can still steer the car. It's just going to take two hands, and you're not going to be able to do it with your finger.
Right, and nowadays most power steerings are electric anyways.
Yeah, and that you bring up a good point. So we haven't lost the electrical system on those kinds of cars. But those are just some of the things that we run into a lot. In this particular case, we didn't really find anything. We found the car had been heavily modified, and we found some modifications that weren't done exactly to the way they should have been. I'm talking about the hubs, the wheel spacers, and then the back, the indentations from the studs on the back side of the wheel spacer, which indicates to me that it didn't sit flush, and so we had a little problem there. But that isn't a reason to cause what happened,
because all the wheels were still attached to the vehicle.
Exactly. They wouldn't have been for very long, I suspect. I think that would have probably, we would have lost a tire and a wheel at some time in the future. But nevertheless, that's not the issue. So, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. When it comes to transmission shops, there's really only one in town that I can send you to. It's the last of the old guys that were brought up on automatic transmissions in the 60s and the 70s, and that's Phil at Automatic Transmission Exchange. He's been around in the Phoenix area since 1968. Phil and his staff are transmission diagnostics experts. They do repairs and replacements. They do flushing. They do service work. And if you have a particular problem and you can make it happen, they're happy to schedule an appointment and have you take one of their technicians for a ride, as long as you don't have them for a week or a month or a year, and you get my drift. You can't have them for hours and hours. That's why I say you got to make it happen in front of them, but you got to make it happen within, you know, a couple of miles. So that's how come you teach yourself how to make it happen, so that you can show them how they can make it happen. 40th Street in Washington is Automatic Transmission Exchange. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back, everybody. 20 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. Mark Salem and Eddie Caruso sitting here working, and both of us are master techs, and both of us have, well, you've been with me 33 years.
Uh-huh.
So we've worked together for 33 years. Sometimes I work for him. Sometimes he works for me. Sometimes I have to counsel him, but, you've counseled me a couple of times. You've offered your suggestions.
It's a give and take.
No, you're right. Oh, boy. Well, when it comes to Sun City, people ask a lot of times. I get some emails that say, you know, I'm in Sun City and where do I go? And my answer is pretty much always the same. Automotive Dynamics is run by Chuck Nides and his family. And I've known Chuck since the late 60s and early 70s when he was in the gas station business back then. So he's one that understands the dynamics of running a good service and shop and family-owned operation. And he started there in Sun City in 1982. So if you're looking for a shop, then I would like to suggest Automotive Dynamics. They're on the north side of Grand, just west of 99th Avenue. So Grand and 99th Avenue, north side. And it's a good place to go. One of the things that Chuck does, that not all the shop owners do, and I don't actually subscribe to this 100% myself, but he doesn't pay his technicians any commissions on what they sell and what they do, because he insists that it prevents them from selling unauthorized stuff. You and I both know that is an issue in our industry, but it's not as big as it used to be.
Right. Well, I mean, the techs call it going for the gravy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And because we're dispatching, it's difficult to do that, because you don't know if you're going to get a whole bunch of hard cars, you know, really difficult cars that you're going to go by book time on all the day long, or whether you're going to get a bunch of softballs worth throwing at you. And there is no book time, and so you make up your own. There's those kinds of dynamics that go on, right?
It's you're right. It's a really dynamic situation. Just to figure that out.
Right. And folks bring that up a lot, too, with respect to book time. So we look at the book, and the book tells us that the average technician, this is about the time it's going to take to do that work. Water pump, 5 hours. At $100 an hour, it's $500 labor, which is not likely on a water pump, but nevertheless. But there's technicians that will beat that time, but I suspect, and you can say what you want, I'm thinking they're not going to beat it by a substantial number, a half an hour or less. Oftentimes, it's going to be, you're going to get close to it. The downside is that if you beat it, you get to keep it, but if you go past it, you eat it.
Exactly. And like if you beat it, you get a raise.
Yeah, and if you don't, you're going to have to contribute some time, uncompensated time.
Right.
Most everybody does that because the guidelines, the book times, are really pretty right on. They really do give us a good blueprint. Now, if you're going to take the valve covers off, and it pays 2 hours to take the valve covers off, but they're covered in an inch worth of grease, and the engine compartment really looks nice, and you say, well, I want to paint them orange and put them back. Well, we got to do blue because it's a Ford. It's leaking
right.
Oil.
What's orange?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're going to paint them. That's going to be on top of whatever it takes to take the valve cover off and put gaskets on it. We're going to take the valve cover off. Then we're going to wash it, clean it, and paint it, and put it back on. And so those are reasons why your bill would be higher. If you called around for a valve cover gasket, he's going to bid it at 3.1 and somebody else bids it at 3.9. If they're painted, then that's the difference.
And all these labor operations where they get the time are on an engine that is brand new, that they're taking them apart and taking the part off and putting the part back on. They're not cleaning it. There is no rust. There are no broken bolts. So
And there's no diagnostic time either to get there.
Correct.
So they're saying, okay, well, how much is it replaced a camshaft in this particular car, make and model Honda, let's pretend. It's an overhead cam. How much to do the camshaft? Well, that's fine, but we still got to figure out it was the camshaft. So there's a diagnostic fee that's going to, okay, it took me 27 minutes to get the valve cover off so I could see that the camshaft is all eaten up. And I can see the problem with the camshaft. So the camshaft needs to be replaced, but we need to fix the problem that caused the camshaft to die an early death. And
right.
So those diagnostic money is on top of whatever the actual repair happens to be. But those are just clues and hints and stuff that, and you can figure out if you call around and get a labor estimate. But I suggest to you that if you give them the specific car, that the labor estimate probably, finish the sentence, won't be, the highest and the lowest won't be what percentage apart.
I would say 15%.
And I would have said 10 to 20 because of the labor rate. Because a guy at 1 hour at $110 an hour is going to be $110. But if a guy at $120 an hour is going to be $120 an hour. So I'm with you. 10, 15, 20% may be different. It'll be a labor rate adjustment. Unless, of course, one guy's standing there and the motor's filthy dirty and he knows he's going to have to dig out these old parts and he's going to have to clean everything when he goes back together with it. What about when you talk about you're going to do a water pump, you take the belts off. That's part of the labor to replace the water pump.
Correct.
So the customer, you call the customer and you say, hey, I got the belts in my hand. Basically, you didn't really pay any extra to have them off because the whole job took them off anyway. Do you want me to put new ones on? The savings is $68 in labor because
right.
I'm already there.
And that's As the customer, that's what you want to do is take advantage of those opportunities. Your car's got 100,000 miles on it. You never replace the belts, but you're doing the water pump. For heaven's sake, put new belts on it. It's just going to cost you the price of the belt.
That's it, and no labor.
Correct.
If you go a week later, a day later, a month later, and come back and put belts on it, it's going to cost you a whole lot of labor. It's going to cost you a whole lot of labor to dig all those belts off. So it's going to make a big difference. So your technician in your shop should be doing this. We had a car in the other day that a friend of mine asked to look at his daughter's car, and it had, I don't know, 30, 40,000 miles on it, and somebody had gone by a 60K service and had bid a 60K service that was over $1,000. My confusion was the car's age didn't put it at 60,000 miles. Assuming that you're driving 12 to 15,000 miles a year.
Okay.
So the car's age didn't put it there. The mileage didn't put it at 60,000 miles. What were they thinking? And I can tell you that I get lots of these, as you well know, because you look up many of them for me. But What bothers me in the big picture here is it's really not dealers, independent chain stores, and small shops. It's everybody. Everybody's playing some silly game sometimes with respect to how the owner's manual is deciphered on the car. And we see, and I know you see, but I see it a whole bunch more, where we've got people with $1,000 worth of work that, according to the owner's manual, should be done at 100, and somebody wants to do it at 60 or 70 or 50.
And to over-service a vehicle is only benefiting one person.
And I tell people that if you think that doing everything with synthetic oil and being really nice to your motor, it's going to love you and last forever, that's a lie. The motor's going to last until you overheat it or it runs low on oil or you just wear it out. It doesn't have a, it has multiple brains, but it doesn't have a loving brain.
It doesn't have a heart.
It doesn't have a heart. It has an oil pump, but it doesn't have a heart.
It's, 1 minute.
The motor's not going to know, and no one's going to care. So you can over-maintenance your car thinking that it's going to love you. But I promise you, it's if it breaks down, it's not because it doesn't love you. It just breaks down. There's not, and if we could make it happen, then it would never break down on your car,
right.
Or my car, or my wife's car, or your many girlfriends' cars. It wouldn't. It wouldn't make them. Oh, there's right. One of them rides a horse. That's what I heard in the shop the other day. Is that right? One of them rides a horse to work. I was just guessing. Anyway, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And my name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is Eddie Caruso. We've worked together for more than 33 years together. We're both ASE Master Techs. It's not important where we work. It's just important that we have a lot of experience we'd like to share. And if you have any questions, you can give us a call. We get lots of questions about coolant and color. We get lots of questions about spark plugs and brands. Those are the kinds of things we can help. 602-508-0960.
Take the
Well, welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. Eddie Caruso, Mark Salem here at your service, and we're going to go straight to the phones. And Vicky called first, and so, Mike, you're going to be second, but I would have taken her anyway. Vicki, good morning. How can we help you? Vicki?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm all ears. What? How can we help you?
Okay. My husband and I are having a disagreement on checking oil. Of course, he never owned a car until it came to this country 20 years ago, and I've got a 97 XJ and a 69 C10, and I check the oil after it's been parked for a while because it's easier. Then it's easier to read after it's been, like, sitting all night. And he says, no, you have to run the engine for a while and then check the oil.
Hold on just a minute while Eddie and I talk. This ain't looking good for him.
No. And it's my opinion that to get a really accurate level check on the oil, the engine needs to sit for, let's say, at least an hour. So all the oil drains back into the crankcase.
Okay, and see, Vicky, the engine, the oil pump takes oil from inside the oil pan at the very bottom of the engine, and it distributes on the top part of the engine for all the valves and the camshafts and the chains. And there's areas there where oil is constantly being sprayed and oiled, and the things are lubricated, and there's oil splashing all over the inside of that motor. In order to get the best, and actually the only, you need to let it sit for a while. And most people will check their cars first thing in the morning. And what's happened is all the oil has then dripped back down to the oil pan, and your dipstick goes into the oil in the oil pan, and that's how you do it. So there's really no benefit to running it because you're not going to get an accurate reading when the oil level, if where it's at between the add and the full mark, because when it's running, you're not going to get an oil a good one because your whole oil system is pressurized, so there's a lot of oil missing out of the pan. And if you check it shortly after you shut it off, you're still not going to get the true. But let me tell you this. I don't know that this is a real big deal because one way or another it's going to be a quarter of a quarter or half a quarter while.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's if you shut the engine off and run around as fast as you can and open the hood and check the oil, it's going to be probably between a half and a quarter quart below the full mark.
Okay, and that's assuming it was at the full mark at the beginning.
Right.
Okay, so I don't know that there's a real big deal on this. I don't think it's gonna. But let's agree on this: you never add oil until it's at the add mark or below. never add oil because the add mark and the full mark are a quart apart. So a lot of people, as soon as it comes off the full mark, they put a quart of oil in it. That's not right. We want you to wait till it hits the add mark or drops below the add mark, and then you add
a quart.
Well,
then you agree with me that, if I check it first thing in the morning before I started, it's a lot better than, like, when I was a kid, we were told to check it when you get gas, and it's really hard to read them.
Yeah, but your husband's on the other line, and he says you parked your car on a slope. You are right. You are more right than he is. And to do it appropriately, it is better to do it first thing in the morning after it's been sitting, and that will give you the true level of the oil. How often are you checking the oil?
Once a month.
Okay. All right. Okay. And let's ask Eddie how often he checks his oil. Eddie, you drive how many miles to work every day?
It's 70 miles round trip.
70 miles round trip. And you drive the Lexus?
Yes.
Okay. The Lexus has how many miles on it?
360,000.
360,000. And Eddie's been with me for 30 years, so I've been through a couple of cars. Now, that Lexus, how often do you add a quart of oil to the Lexus?
I don't in between oil changes.
So are you doing 3,000 mile oil changes?
I'm doing 10,000.
10,000?
Yes.
Okay. So you're doing 10,000. It's not using a quart of oil in 10,000 miles.
No, it's not.
Okay. That's unusual for a 300,000 mile car. Okay.
Right.
And in most cases, would you agree with me? Here, finish the sentence, Eddie. Most people are a quart low at about how many miles?
I would say between 5,000 and 6,000 miles.
And I would say 3,000 to 5,000 miles. I'm trying to capture all those Fords that are leaking oil like crazy.
Well,
and all
Vicky
that
is an anomaly because she says she checks her oil.
Yeah. Well, you're right. You're right. There's a lot of wives out there that are not interested in doing that.
Even the husbands.
Yeah. Well, even the husbands.
But
right.
I mean, yeah. If you pull into a gas station and you're filling it up, and you're checking the oil, and it's below the add mark.
How far below the add mark? If it's a half an inch below the add mark, then there you probably can put a quart in that.
Right.
But if it's the thickness of 10 pieces of paper below the add mark, no one cares.
Right.
No one cares.
But the most important thing is check the oil level.
Yeah. Yeah. We have lots of engines, cars, and trucks that are towed in with the motors rather tight because they've exploded within. And an oil starvation problem is the cause of the damage to the engine. And so it we do see them, and it does happen, but I think your way is better and safer than your husband's, with all due respect.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
You bet, Vicki. Good luck to you. Mike, you're up. How can we help you?
Oh, hey, Mark. Thank you so much.
You bet.
I've got a 2014 Honda Accord EXL 6-cylinder, and the car's running fine, except about a week ago, my dashboard lit up like a Christmas tree, and in the middle it goes FCW system failed. And my question is it safe to drive? Because it's driving fine, air's running, everything's running, but I've got this system failure thing, which got the the tire pressure things lit up, the traction things lit up, the LDW and FCW is lit up. And so my main concern, number one, is it still safe to drive? And should I get it repaired? Or can I just have it shut off?
Well, and right now it starts when you ask it. And does the speedometer work, or is the dashboard just completely non-existent?
Well, I mean, in the middle of the speedometer, it's got that FCW fail thing blinking.
Okay.
But everything else is working. The gauges are working. I mean, the temperature gauge, the gas gauge is working.
Okay. All right.
The car's running like it's nothing wrong with it other than this weird thing. And it starts out without it coming on in about a minute, 2 minutes. Well, it maybe could be longer, even up to 10 minutes. Then it'll pop out in this FCW system fail thing. Will start
Why don't
blinking.
You grab, take my phone and Google that, because we're going to take a break right now, and Google that FCW Honda Accord.
SCW?
S is in Sam?
No, F is in Frank, C is in Charles, W
William.
As in W.
Yeah, yeah. William. Okay.
It's like front collision warning, I think.
Okay,
where it beeps if you get close to a car in front of you.
Okay. If in fact that's it, forward collision warning system, if that's it, then every other aspect of the motor and the transmission are going to be fine. It's just telling you that it's not going to blow up a bunch of lights and sirens on your dashboard if you're looking at the pretty girl at the bus stop and you're coming up and you're going to rear end a car. Okay? It's not going to apply the brakes. It's not going to do what it's supposed to do. Other than that, there's nothing wrong with the motor.
Right. Now, on this vehicle, does it have a camera on the backside of the rearview mirror?
It's the full deal. You know, it's the EXL, and it's got all the bells and whistles.
All right, Eddie, why are you shaking your head?
Well, because it's forward looking. It's looking to see if there's something in its way.
Okay.
So it sounds like for some reason it can't see what's in front of it. You've put blinders on that camera, or something has happened with that camera.
You haven't had anybody paint the backside of your mirror. You haven't had anybody put any tint on the backside of your mirror. You haven't had anybody scrub the backside of the mirror with an SOS pad, right?
No.
Okay.
I have not done. The only thing I've had done to it is I read something in these forums that maybe has to do with bearings. I had the top hat bearings replaced and the shocks replaced just about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago. And I don't know if that affects a cable or whatever that deals with all this stuff. I don't know.
I don't know about any cable at all.
Yeah, that doesn't.
There's an electric camera in there. You might have a cable that operates your own mirror, but it's unlikely. But we've been wrong before. This isn't something we've seen.
And I don't know. And, you know, these forums, you know, you never know what you're getting out of those either. So I have one last question, if I can.
Okay.
I was supposed to get I got an oil change about when they were doing this top hat and the struts and everything, but when I look at the oil gauge, it's down to 15%, and I've got the little wrench coming up. I'm wondering, does it automatically reset when you put the oil in, or did maybe they didn't put oil in and it's still showing that's why I went in to start with, because I knew my oil was going down.
Okay, I can answer that.
Now it's only like 15%.
Okay, I got to run, but I can answer that. He didn't reset the reminder. When we do the oil change, we're supposed to put the reminder back at zero and say, hey, by the way, we just changed the oil, and reset it. So he didn't reset it, so you're at 15. I don't know what you were at the beginning. It's just a mistake that the technicians make. Eddie has done it his whole life, and we'll be back right after this. And welcome back, everybody. 46 minutes after the hour, 10 o'clock. You got a car call question. You've got a good chance of getting an open line right now because there's five of them. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. One more time, 602-508-0960. Blackwell Auto is the guy that's at Greenway and 40th Street. And Tom kind of handles that whole northeast section of Scottsdale and Phoenix and Fountain Hills and that kind of stuff. I would love to have 5, even 10 shops that covered that. It's just difficult to find a shop that fits the parameters that I insist that we all abide by. There's shops up there, but they don't have an owner that's been there more than a year or two or three. Then if you look at their Google, some of their reviews, they're not real favorable, considering that mine aren't perfect either. I mean, I'm not a 5-star guy, and I hold people to the same that I'm hold myself to. But it also has to do with the vendors say, well, he doesn't always pay his bills on time. Or the reviews might say something to the effect of that I had a warranty problem, and so did I. And those are troublesome. So the guys that have lots of years, that have ASE certified technicians, that have been in the same building for a lot of years, those are the stable guys that have been around, and Blackwell fits that perfectly. So if you're looking for a great shop in Northeast Phoenix or North Scottsdale, Blackwell Auto, 40th Street and Greenway, he's a good guy, and we have a caller. Who might that be?
Say hello to Sam.
Sam, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I was helping a friend work on a 2001 Chevy Monte Carlo 3.4 liter engine, and it had a lower intake gasket leak.
Okay.
It was leaking coolant, and so we replaced that, and before we replaced it, I mean, the car would just lose coolant, but it was running fine, it would start fine, but I did notice the plenum intake vacuum port that I think went to like a tank, a vacuum tank, was disconnected or broken.
Okay.
So there's a vacuum leak in the intake plenum. Anyway, we put it all back together, start it, and go to start it, and it won't start unless you keep your foot on the pedal. And this is when I had that vacuum port capped off after we did the repair of the gasket. And if you take that, if we open the port, that vacuum port is a little tiny little spigot, like sticking out of the intake plenum by the alternator. If we open that and create a vacuum leak, it actually starts, but it runs really rough. So I can't figure it out.
We're both looking at one another right now.
So when you hold it to the floor, when that vacuum port is plugged and it starts up, will it idle smoothly once you back your foot off the throttle?
No, it'll die right away. You have to keep the gas pedal pushed.
But if that vacuum port is unplugged, it will start a little bit easier and run, but runs really rough?
Rough, very rough, yeah.
Black smoke rough?
Because I thought, yeah, it idles rough.
Okay.
It sometimes dies, but there's sometimes it won't die. You don't need to put your foot on the pedal. And I thought it was the idle air control, so I actually took that off and tried to start it, letting a lot of air in the intake with that valve out, and it wouldn't even start unless you had the foot on the pedal.
Yeah, but you're creating a big vacuum leak when you do that. And the idle air control motor does one thing, and it just opens and closes a very small vacuum leak to maintain an idle that the computer wants it to maintain. So, yeah, the idle air control motor, I don't know that it would start no matter what if it had a bad idle air control motor. It just wouldn't idle.
Right, or have a very low idle.
Yeah, yeah. So
but the idle air control motor doesn't really affect the way the engine runs. It just controls idle speed.
Right. Can you think of anything?
I'm thinking of maybe, I'm not sure if this is a mass airflow engine or a MAP system. We got a sensor that's unplugged.
And doesn't know that we're aspirating air into the motor. We doesn't know that we're sucking air into the motor, and so it's not going to add any fuel to it because it doesn't think we're cranking over or we lost crank signal.
Right, and I mean a couple of things was key on, engine off. Does the check engine light come on?
And does the oil pump or does the fuel pump hum for a second, then go off?
Right, and then when you get it to start and it's running, no matter whether it's running rough, does a check engine light? Is it on when it's running or is it go off once it's started?
Because that indicates a hard failure versus a soft failure,
right.
in a generic way. A hard failure, the engine light stays on no matter what, and that's a big dog problem. And a check engine light can be reset.
So does a check engine light go off once it's started?
Well, I mean, we had the battery disconnected, so when we first started, there was no check engine, no codes, and I checked the codes, and there was nothing in the, I guess, background.
Well, when you turn the key on a car, I don't care about the history of the battery or the charge and all that. When you turn the key on, the check engine light should come on and then go off.
Now, I'm thinking back to
the
3.4 is based on the 3.1 engine, and I know on those engines, to pull the lower intake out, you have to take the push rods and the rocker arms off. Was that your case too?
Yeah. And
okay.
I used the tool. I didn't disconnect the rocker arms. I used the tool to lift up the rocker arm.
And pull the push rods out?
Because if I'm not mistaken,
the intake and exhaust push rods are different lengths. So it may have been that you got a couple mismatched, and you got a long one and a short one. So you got an intake where the exhaust push rods should go?
I put them in a box and lined them up and put them back in how they came out.
Okay.
Well, we're out of guesses. I mean, it's a fixable problem. You just have to determine, are we getting spark? Do we have good compression? Do we have valve timing exactly the same? Is the injector squirting? Do we have fuel pressure? Those are all the things. If it doesn't start and run, the question to you is it spark or fuel?
Well, I checked the fuel, and with the key on, it had pressure, and when I started it, it went up and turned it off, and that. The gauge on the fuel line when it was off held. I don't think it's a fuel problem.
Okay. Well, it can be a fuel problem because if you have fuel pressure, line pressure at the rail, but you're not opening and closing the injectors, that's going to be a problem.
So, but if you step on the gas a little bit, it does.
See, I mean, those, all the symptoms you have are very confusing to the two of us. They're, you know, obviously once you fix the car, you're going to be able to explain all these really weird things that are going on. But right now it's spark fuel, it's electronic, the crankshaft sensor, the camshaft sensor, all that kind of stuff has to be talking to the computer.
I mean, guess one of the first things I would do is just double check as far as your spark plug wires that they're on the correct cylinder and on the correct tower on the coil pack. It's kind of hard to get them mixed up at the cylinder head because they're different lengths and the way they're routed and normally the way they're held together with the retainers. But it's,
at
it's
the coil,
easier
it's
to get
different.
Them mixed up at the coil tower, the coil pack.
So my friend did drive the car and he said, hey, the check engine light came on now. He's driving it.
We don't diagnose stuff based on check engine lights. I mean, you know, that's just telling you the computer sees something it doesn't understand. You know, it's we're not going to stop right there and go chase the check engine light. We're still going to work on spark and fuel and vacuum and timing and that kind of stuff. And you're at a disadvantage because you don't have a scanner. And we were going to plug a scanner in, and the scanner, we're going to watch all these things happen. And we're going to be able to see what fuel delivery is and what spark is and all that other kind of stuff. We're going to have a lot of serial stream data in front of us that we can look at. And we can actually monitor all of that stuff. So,
I mean, at least now if he's driving it, then it's somewhat
we're closer
quote, drivable. And the check engine light will give you a route to follow, a path to go down.
Yeah, another data point. Okay.
All right.
Hey,
good luck to you.
Guys.
You bet. Anyway, 602-508-0960, and we've just got about 3 or 4 minutes left in this particular part of the. Oh, we have a caller, and who might that be?
Say hello to Don.
Don, good morning. How can we help you?
Brother from another mother.
Brother from another mother. Does a tow truck? Have you had an intimate experience with a tow truck in a while?
I'm trying to go like. Easy retirement.
Never mind. You're. Yeah, this is a bad. I should have never opened that door. But anyway, good morning.
You shouldn't have.
Good morning to you. What's
How
on
are
your
you?
Mind? I'm good.
Okay. My S10 with a 4.3. I have a check engine light. It says it was weak on left bank. So I'm going okay. I changed the fuel filter. I changed the oil because it
2 minutes.
And I didn't know about the fuel filter. Because I've never changed it since I bought the truck. So I'm blowing through it, and it's, you know, hard to go through. So I'm going, okay, now can I just disconnect the battery and go do a drivability test and see if it comes back, or can I just go through emissions again?
No, you're going to have to clear it, and you're going to have some miles and history on it, because it's not going to clear all the data until it sees good data for a long period of time. So they know that you can disconnect the battery and reset everything, but they're not going to let you run.
I missed the first part. What did he say? Did he say it failed emissions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it failed emissions, and so he's worked on it. And so at this particular point, he has to go through a couple of drive cycles to otherwise they're going to say that he just disconnected
the battery. What year was this again?
2003.
So does it have a check engine light or just hasn't completed all the monitors?
It's got a check engine light. I ran it through emissions.
One minute.
Just run it anyway. She says, okay, but it's going to come up not pass. So I said, okay, but I still got to have it, you know.
Okay.
And so I need to get somebody with, of course, it needs to be tuned, and I've got all the parts, but you know, getting my hands down in there, it's like tearing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you're not going to be able to stall emissions, so you're going to be late and there's a penalty for being late, but it's a matter of really just getting it running and getting the check engine light to be off and stay off and getting through so many ignition cycles.
Right, but also if you test emissions and you fail before your registration expires, you have a 1 month grace period where they're not going to charge you a late fee to register the vehicle.
Okay, and so you got that. But if you have any questions, I got 9 seconds before we go into the next hour. But anyway, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open, and we'll be right back.
I want to once again, here's Mark.
Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, and we're going to be here for another hour talking about car repair questions, car repair problems, and stuff like that. And I want to tell you about a couple of good shops, guys that know how to fix cars, and guys you can trust to fix cars. Kurt's Auto Repair is up at I-17 and Bell Road. He's been around since 1987. He works on both gas and diesels. He, like most all of us, has ASE-certified technicians, which means your vehicle is going to be repaired by a well-trained and certified professional, somebody who's actually passed the test. So those are important considerations. So if you're anywhere near I-17 and Bell, may I suggest, if you don't have a shop already that you absolutely love, then may I suggest that you try Kurtz Automotive, northeast corner of Scottsdale, or I-17 and Bell. Let's talk about what we talked about during the break. We've had two cars. We had that Monte Carlo 3.1 yes. come in, and then we had Don's, what do you have, a 2.8 or?
4.3 S10.
When those cars hit the shop, I'm gonna say something and then you follow up. There's a process that we do. We don't care about the check engine lights and we don't care about this and that and the other. We're looking for spark and fuel and timing and engine vacuum and stuff like that and
Correct.
Fuel pressure. So the fundamentals and the basics are what we have to do. On a carbureted engine, we only needed three things for it to run. I'm going to ask them to you, and if you can't get them, I'll help you.
Compression, spark, and fuel.
Yeah, all right. So those are real fundamentals. On many of the cars of today, we can actually determine that to a large extent by just cranking it over with our expensive scanners and looking at the scanner. Oftentimes, we can see fuel pressure if we have a fuel pressure
right.
gauge hooked up. As far as compression is concerned, it's not really hard because that's related to vacuum.
Right, that's inferred with the vacuum. So if it's cranking and it doesn't have compression, there isn't going to be any kind of vacuum reading.
Right. And so this is all stuff that's second nature to us. And so to go in and determine what's causing the check engine light, we're just going to go in there and we're not going to have a book in front of us, the senior guys. And I would say that there's what percentage of all the guys working on cars today have the senior status level, do you think? I'm thinking 25 or 35%?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, that have been there, done that, been in the industry for a very, very long time. It's not that hard, but what happens is if you don't understand the fundamentals, if you don't understand what the computer's looking at, if you don't understand if you don't understand fuel pressure regulators that are bad, that flood the motor, if you don't understand that 3.1, the spark plugs have to be wired at the coil correctly.
Right.
And because they're sequenced. So when we send spark to number 5, we don't want it going to number 7 because you plug the wire into number 7.
That's right.
Right?
And even a senior check, just with his ears, can tell if a car has compression or not.
Exactly.
When it comes in, it's going, well, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
There is no compression. We need to find out why.
All right, well, give me the good compression. Good. So it's a sewing machine sound, or it's got a compression to it. It's you can hear it. And as far as fuel's concerned, do we really care if it has a fuel system? Aren't we just going to get a can of carb spray and just fire it down the intake and start that thing up with a can of carb spray?
That's one of the easiest things to do.
Yeah.
Or just a can of propane and
exactly.
introduce it into the air filter housing.
Exactly. We're done. So for us to get the timing and fuel and spark and all that kind of stuff, it just doesn't take that long. But folks, it's not like we're going to bill you for 7 minutes of his time because he has to go get the propane and he has to do this and he has to do that. And these are tests that he's running that kind of short circuit the whole testing procedure just because of the experience level.
Right. There's a shortcut to get to what are we missing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first step. But then we have to determine why are we missing
it.
So if we don't have fuel and we put propane on it and the car starts up, okay, well, we know we have compression.
Mm-hmm.
We know we have spark.
Yep.
But we don't have fuel. Now we need to figure out why do we not have fuel.
Now, I'll name one, you name one. If we don't have fuel, I'm going to take the easy one, fuel pump. Go ahead.
Fuel pump relay.
Okay. Fuel pressure regulator.
It's out of fuel.
That's the most common one.
Right.
It is.
I remember we had
a girl
that was driving an Explorer, like a late 90s Explorer, and it has, you know, the distance to empty.
Uh-huh.
and it came in because it died. And she says, I don't know. I mean, it says I have 8 miles left to go.
Yeah.
This thing gets 16 miles to the gallon, which means she had, at best, a half a gallon of fuel in the vehicle.
And, folks, the pickup tube goes from the top of the tank downward, and on the end of it, it's got a sock on it to keep some of the trash out from going to the motor. You're not going to suck the bottom of the tank dry because we don't want the trash that's there. So you're always going to have a little fuel left in the tank.
Right. And when your tank is, 2 feet wide and 5 feet long, a half a gallon of fuel in there is just a whisper.
Yeah. There's a bunch of cowboys, and well, there's cows out there that have that. They could take a leak in there and fill that tank up. It's just a minor amount of fuel.
Right.
And so those are the kinds of things that we have when we're charged with it. It's, does it have compression? Well, I didn't check it. I know, but you can hear it. You can literally hear it. If anything, you can take one spark plug out and take the spark plug wire and stick it in your right ear. Take your thumb and put it over the spark plug hole and then have somebody hit the key.
I want to see that. Yeah. I'll ask the next new guy if he can do that.
Exactly. What we're talking about is that in the old days, when we had points and condensers, long before we ended up with electronic ignition, which was in the 70s, mid-70s,
yeah.
Late 70s, okay. In the old days, when you got bit by the spark on those systems, it was hardly anything.
It made you laugh.
It made you laugh. It wasn't even a bee sting. It wasn't anything. So we morph into electronic ignitions, and Chevy and Ford and Chrysler, and then we morph into these direct ignition systems where we got coils that sit on top of spark plugs. Folks, when you get bit by that electricity, you normally mess your pants one way or the other. It hurts. It scares you.
You cry and you're not dry.
And you don't want to get hit by that, and you know not to. But the new guy always gets broken in some fashion like that. And I've seen you guys out there. We have a new guy that shows up. And somebody has a spark plug wire that's 10 inches or 10 feet long, and you plug it into the engine, and you hide the wire, and you bring it into the bottom of the seat. The guy's told to go get that car and move it over here. He sits down in the seat. He hits the key. All of a sudden, he doesn't know what to do. And it's just part of the break-in period, you know what I mean, of what we do for this kind of stuff. But that was the transition from yesterday. Today, we don't have carburetors, so we can't look to see if there's any fuel in the bowl. We can't look to see if there's any fuel pressure. And today, we don't even know if there's fuel being sprayed into the cylinders.
Right. And it used to be we could, if it had a return fuel system, we could pull the return line going back to the tank and just turn the key on. And if we had fuel coming out, then we know that the fuel pump is working.
Because it's a loop, folks. We take electric fuel pumps in the tank, and we push fluid forward, gas forward to the engine. Then there's a fuel pressure regulator. So it's given at 60 pounds, but the pressure regulator says, I only need 30. So it's going to send 30 back to the tank. So it's a loop. It's a big loop. So you got 60 to the regulator and then 30 back to the tank. And I'm using simple numbers
right. That
don't really mean anything right now. Well, the idea is you're right. And you can, I would suggest that you can touch the return line with your fingers and see if we got fuel running back to the tank.
Right.
You can feel it. And so those are the kinds of things that we work on. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. On your personal cars, what kind of oil are you using? Conventional, semi-synthetic?
Full synthetic.
Full synthetic. And what kind of oil change intervals are you plugged into?
I'm 10,000.
Okay. And your cars are what vintage years?
I have a 97 Ford Explorer, 2001 Lexus LS 430. Those are my daily drivers.
Those are, okay. And they both have hundreds of thousands of miles.
They both are over 300,000 miles.
Okay, so you're going 10,000 miles on a synthetic oil change.
Yes.
Are you adding oil in the 10,000 miles?
On the Explorer, yes, because it has a little bit of an oil leak.
Okay. But on
I
the
just
Lexus,
haven't gotten around to pull the engine to fix it. Yeah.
So on the other side, the Lexus, no problems there.
No problems at all.
Okay, and you're not, but you are checking the oil. See, that's something that people, I don't think that they have a good grasp. Going from a 3,000-mile oil change to a 10,000 or even a 15,000, I think on my truck, I'm at 14 or 15,000. But I also hold what, 10 quarts, 8 quarts, 10 quarts in my diesel in the 6.7?
Oh, you're 11 quarts.
11 quarts, yeah. So, I mean, I got plenty of oil. It's not like it, but there is a difference, and your 10,000 miles, that get, but you also, how, what's your round trip?
70 miles.
70 miles to work and back, because you live on the west side and we're in the south Tempe. So those are things, but people shouldn't be afraid of synthetic oil. They just have to remember to check it every once in a while.
Right, and like you say, it depends on how many miles you drive. So if you don't drive a lot, you're really not going to get the benefit of running a synthetic oil and changing your oil every 2 years, because you don't want to neglect your car for that long.
Right, and part of the oil change is the checkover.
Right.
Tires, fluids, belts, hoses, exhaust leaks. We're looking at things that are showing symptoms of being a problem. And so the oil change is a very sophisticated inspection of your car. And we're not there to sell you. We're there to find issues that aren't going to last till you come back in 10,000 miles.
And we get to see your car in a way you've never seen it before. I mean, and we'll have customers say, I've never seen the underside of my car. Can I come out and look at it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Come on out. Come on out. And there's a lot there that we can look at. We can look at weeping, seeping, dripping, and gushing. Would that be fair?
I would have put leaking in there as well.
Weeping,
seeping,
leaking,
gushing.
Gusher. Okay, fair enough. Okay. And that can be any kind of fluid on the car.
Right.
Any kind of fluid. Then on top of that, you're looking at the tailpipe. They're tan, they're brown, they're black, they're double black, and yeah, they're triple black. We're talking gas motors now. We know that it needs to be tan or a light black. We don't want it to be carbon black, and we don't want to be able to stick our fingers in there and then with our fingernails just scrape out a bunch of carbon. There's a problem there. We don't need an emissions report to tell us that.
Right.
Shock absorbers leaking. And tires showing abnormal wear because the shock absorber's leaking. And you want to do shocks at the axle at a time. So if you need a pair, thank you for that. If you need a left front, we're gonna try to sell you a right front as well, because we're gonna have to do an alignment. We're gonna have to do some major, take it out and put it back in. And this is something that should last 100,000 miles, and it's, so you don't have to worry about it. But let's do it right if we're gonna do it. And I think most shops would agree with that.
Right.
So anyway, 602-508-0960 if you have a car question or a car problem. And we're really good at, my wife does this and my husband says this is the way we ought to do it. We're really good at that.
Oh, well, we told Vicky she was right.
Yeah, that's because we were afraid. That's the truth. 602-508-0960. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. Let me tell you about a couple of good shops here in town that I can tell you are really great places. They know what they're doing, and I've known their owners for a very long time. And I tell you this because I think it's beneficial if I find shops that are geographically located throughout the valley. And that gives you an opportunity to pick one if you don't already have one. But if you have a shop and you're really happy with the shop and you've been their customer for years, I would be the first one to tell you to stay right where you're at. On the other hand, right now we have a whole lot of selling going on. We've got the Sun Devil, 28 Sun Devils chain stores were repurchased by a company not too long ago. We've had some tire stores that have been repurchased. We've had a mechanical shop not too far away from our shop that was repurchased. So we have a lot of investors buying up some chains of car repair. And that's always been a concern, because typically the prices go up because
right.
of the significant of the millions of dollars they've spent to buy the facility. And so we're seeing that right now. And there's two trains of thought from a position as the pilot of the airplane for me and Renee. Is, do we follow him, or do we just take small steps behind him, or do we match him? Those are the kinds of things
right.
that goes on with labor rates. So you got a guy there at what are we right now?
We are 150.
150. There's guys out there that are going to be a whole bunch more than we are, and there's going to be guys out there that are going to be a little bit less than we are. We try to position ourselves at the 60% mark, somewhere around there.
Yeah, we're typically less than a dealership. And,
oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
maybe a little bit higher than some of the independents.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that, because we have mom-and-pop shops that just work on two or three cars a day. And then we have chain stores that work on a lot of cars a day. Then we have independents that are small and big independents. Our shop's 20 bays deep. And then we also have dealerships. So we have all this movement going on, including the dealerships, with respect to ownership changes and stuff like that. And, of course, sales philosophies and service philosophies change when the new owners come in.
Right. And I really enjoy being here for the last 33 years because I get to meet the customer. I get to talk with the customer. On a dealership level, those techs are, they're a half a mile away from the front counter.
Yeah.
They never get to sometimes ask the customer questions that would pertain to what's going on with their car. They don't have that personal relationship.
Well, and folks, I need to tell you too that Eddie has been hit in the head so many times and scrambled his brain and stuff. His bay is the fishbowl bay. When you look from the lobby through the service rider areas, he has the next two hoists in that area. So he's in what we call the fishbowl bay, and you don't care.
No,
there's a lot of
guys
that
like me there because I'm clean.
That's true. We got a couple of pig pens that work for us, like everybody else has a couple of pig pens, and that's okay. That's just, you're not going to put a pig pen in a very expensive car with white leather, unless of course you cover all the seats with seat covers before they get there. But it's just one of those things. Well, thank you for the compliment. I'll pass that on. We've got Bobby.
Hello.
Bobby, how can I help you?
Hey, yeah, I was driving a friend's Ford Explorer yesterday. I had to move it for him. It's a 2010. And I was, a couple of times when I passed vehicles on these two-lane roads on the way to Vegas, doing about 65, 70, and when it kicked down into the passing gear,
mm-hmm.
It stalled. And it did that twice yesterday.
It falls on its face. Does the engine die, or you just run out of power instantly?
Yeah, it just it ran out of power, and it had stalled. I had to pull over to the side of the road, and it started right up though, and
okay.
It was not overheating. The temperature gauge was right, just a little bit below the middle.
Okay. Well, just so everybody understands, the temperature gauge on your car, when you have a gauge, it is perfectly acceptable to be two or three needle widths to the left or the right of the half mark. We don't care.
Right.
Yeah. So your description is perfect.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Explorer, who's driven Explorers ever since the day I met him and has never owned a Chevrolet in his life.
But my Explorers are all rear-wheel drive.
Oh, yeah.
So was this going up a hill? How much fuel was in the tank? Anything that you can equate that to?
Yeah, it was about two-thirds full. I was on a flat road, perfectly flat, and when I put the power to it and it kicked down in the passing gear, old times, it about a half hour apart from each time, it just died.
Okay, did the engine literally die and you had to put it in a neutral, coast off to the side of the road and restart it?
Yeah.
Okay, now
that's
when
what
you
I did, yeah, I put all right, it in a neutral.
All right, and when you restarted it, did you have to crank for a while, or did it catch the minute you hit the key?
Yeah, it caught the minute I hit it.
So, all right, we're going to think out loud
now. I had this happen on my Lexus.
Okay.
The scenario was a couple times when I went to pass, I'd put it to the floor, it kicked down, it'd go whoa, whoa, and just fall on its face. I'd back off the throttle, and it would recover. The last time it did the same thing, and it died, and
okay.
It left me on the side of the freeway.
Okay.
What happened was somehow a leaf had got past the air filter and got sucked up into the sampling tube on the mass airflow sensor.
Okay.
And there was no air going across that. I could start the car, it would start, and a half second later it would die. When it finally got stuck in there where it wouldn't come out. So at this point, I'd be looking for something on a restriction or something with the mass airflow sensor on that.
Okay.
And we have some debris or something that's on there.
All right. Is the Explorer got the one in the hose that goes to the intake manifold and to the
yes.
mouth? Okay. So the mass airflow sensor is going to be a device that's going to be on the hose that feeds air to the top of the engine. And you're going to want to take the two clamps off that?
Well, the first thing to do is unattach the the top of the air filter housing from the air filter box.
Okay.
And so you'll have the, when you do that, you have the air filter sitting in the box and look into that tube that's going to the engine.
Okay.
That's the first thing to
okay.
do.
Okay. All right.
And see if you see any.
Hey,
know,
let me
breeze.
Throw in one other thing I
sure.
just thought of.
Two minutes.
When I went to get gas in it,
uh-huh.
The gas cap was missing. Could that have anything to do with it?
Not as far as the fuel delivery, no.
No, that would cause a check engine light.
For an evap system.
And yeah, and it did have a check engine light that came on, too.
Okay.
I figured it was due to the gas cap.
Yeah.
Missing.
I don't think the gas cap would cause it to die or to run out of fuel or anything like that. The evaporative system on the car is what? We've got a closed system in the fuel tank, and we're going to suck the fumes off and send them forward and burn them again. So we're not going to let the fumes go into the atmosphere and contaminate the air we breathe. So the evaporative system's singular job is to suck the fumes, the gas fumes off the tank, and burn them to the engine.
And some of those, it's possible there could be a capless system as well.
Oh, yeah.
There is no fuel cap.
Yeah, yeah. I think what I would do is probably, I'd probably take the fuel filter out and blow through it. And probably put a fuel pressure tester on it, a gauge on it, and go drive it?
Well, I think on that one, that it's a returnless system. So the fuel filter is in the bottom of the fuel tank on the fuel sender assembly.
Oh, so we're not going to be doing that.
No, it's one of those filter for life.
Yeah. Do you believe that?
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it doesn't have an external filter.
Oh, do you believe that it's a filter for life?
Sure. Once it gets clogged, its life is done.
Oh, Jesus. Now, how often have you... All right, so answer this question. Typically, and we're not going to be able to answer, I'm going to ask
right.
a question. Typically, how long does it last? And so when we come back, you stay right there, Bobby, because I got to take a break here in about 9 seconds. And so you're going to answer, that filter inside the tank needs to be replaced somewhere in this time or this mileage, and I'm going to give you some slack, and I'm also going to give you 4 minutes to think about it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. Okay, we were talking to Bobby. Bobby's got this Explorer, and he's driving it across
to Vegas, across
the hellhole of the state of Arizona on the west side, and intermittently on hard throttle, the engine's falling on its face
and dying. He
and dying.
Goes off to the side of the road
right.
and restart it.
Okay, so give me your best.
Well, like I said, I was looking at something with that's affecting the mass airflow sensor on a hard acceleration. That it's doing something. So with that volume of air, something is causing an issue.
Okay, and he really only has two choices. He either waits till it gets worse and easier to find, and happens more often,
right.
or he starts guessing, and guessing's going to be expensive. Because if you were going to guess, where do you go? Now, one of the things is if he had a relationship with his repair shop. He had been a customer for 10 years. Those of us that have those kinds of customers, and we have plenty of them ourselves,
yes.
it's not uncommon for us to plug a scanner in and say, here, you monitor this, push this button when you start the car and push this, you know, and get them involved in it.
Right,
so
or let me take your car home. I'll drive it at home.
Yep. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking worst case is that, boy, I'd hate to have that thing die and not restart in the middle of
yeah.
the desert
yeah.
between here and Vegas.
Right. No, you're right. But we don't have any choice on that. And there's a lot of shops. The owners get mad at me when I say we'll send it home with a technician. They say we don't do that, and that's okay because if you own the shop, you can make that decision.
Right.
But in some cases, we do make that. But first, we want to do some cursory inspections. First, we want to see fuel pressure and fuel filter, and we want to look at historical codes, and we want to look at some serial stream data. We want to go drive the car, stuff like that.
Yeah, and we were talking about that on that one. The fuel filter is in the tank.
Okay, how long is that good for?
You know, it's totally different from an inline fuel filter.
Okay.
Because on an inline fuel filter, it's a dead end. Once the contaminants get into the filter, there's no way to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
On the in-tank filter, it has the advantage of that there's not a dead end, that anything that it sucks into that filter, when the car is shut off and there's no longer suction from the fuel pump, some of that debris can fall out of the filter and become suspended back again into the fuel tank.
Okay.
So
Can we drop a camera down the neck of the tank with a light on the end of it?
You can't, because now they have rollover valves, so you can't.
Oh, you can't get down
there. You can't
there.
Get anything. You can't get a hose in there to siphon out. But
what
I know on my Lexus, I had a Carfax when I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
When I did the fuel pump at 300 and something thousand miles,
okay.
It was the original fuel pump and original filter.
Okay.
Really, a lot of it goes to where are you getting your fuel?
Right.
The station, or, you know, how are they maintaining their fuel supply to the pump?
But in their defense, though, if that were a real problem, we had a tank full of dirt and it was be dispensed, it wouldn't take long before somebody in the area would figure that out.
Oh, right.
You know, it's more likely. But my point is this is going to be really hard to diagnose.
Yes.
And there's probably going to be some guessing involved.
Right.
Let's try this. Let's try that. And that's all we've got to work with until it dies and doesn't restart, and then it's real easy to find.
Right. And on those in-tank filters, typically the fuel pump dies before the filter ever gets so plugged up that the car will not run.
And you're going to do the fuel filter and the pump at the same time because you're in the same place.
And it's normally, a lot of times it comes as what we call a fuel hanger, that whole thing. It's the sender, it's the pump, it's the tank. Sometimes you have to do it piecemeal. Replace
okay.
the pump and then replace the filter.
So in that particular case. But, Bobby, that's the best we can offer you. Harry, how are you?
Fine. How are you guys doing today?
We're good.
Very
we're
well.
Good.
Glad you got your Ford Guru, because I wanted to ask a few questions about my Ford.
Okay.
Okay, it's a 2019 Ford F-150 crew cab. With the 3.5 EcoBoost, and it's an XLT. Now,
SLT, is that like medium rare or something like that? What is that?
Excellent.
Oh,
XLT.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Harry.
Okay. So anyway, being an XLT, and I didn't know this. I thought I'd really done research on it, but the four-wheel drive system that it has, you're not supposed to drive on a hard surface. You know, it's supposed
One
to be,
minute.
you know, dirt or you know, ice or snow or whatever. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, at a place up north, you're coming up and you're hitting some snow and stuff. And the four-wheel drive systems that have the, I guess, the all-wheel drive and have the clutch system in the transfer case. But the bad thing about this is the XLT package, you cannot get that particular system, and you have to go up to a Larry or whatever. And the only place I ever found that gave information about this was at the owner's manual.
Oh, what?
I had already bought.
You're going to admit you even read it?
Well, yeah, because I hadn't owned a Ford in a long time.
Okay.
Since 1968, so.
Okay.
That's well, basically the two Ford pickers.
All right. Address the, I mean,
I have no issues with driving a four-wheel drive on any hard surface. There's going to, the differential is going to take
right.
care of any.
Front or rear.
Front or rear of any different right. wheel speed from either side, either corner.
But let's look at the extremes. The extreme is I'm doing 45 miles an hour on a snow-packed road, and I'm going straight. Okay, for
okay.
a long period of time. That's one extreme.
You're
the other
driver.
One, yeah, yeah. Well, if I'm in a Ford, I got a tow truck behind me anyway. But the second part is that you're out there in deep snow and you're trying to find a cabin in Heber after they had 2 foot of snow. The
right.
two extremes.
Right.
You know what I mean? The problem is they don't want there to be a significant amount of slip from one axle or one wheel to the other. They don't want to have the front axle doing 50 miles an hour and the back axle doing 10 miles an hour. And it's not going to happen. Just don't do stupid stuff like that. I'm sure you won't, Harry. But I don't have any problem with driving it off-road or on-road. If I need four-wheel drive to maintain motion, I'm going to use four-wheel drive.
And, I mean, and if you're relying on four-wheel drive to get you out of something, you're not doing 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You're crawling.
Yeah. So I don't know why that's it, why they put that. I would say that maybe their four-wheel drives aren't as tough as the Chevys and Dodges. I guess it would be the only thing.
Here's the thing. Back in the 50s and 60s, the four-wheel drive system they had on the vehicles that I checked on or used were like that. It specifically said that if you come up, out of the desert onto a hard, surface like asphalt, you're supposed to get out and flip your
you know, your freewheeling hubs to a free instead of lock because of the transfer case.
Well, there's
so I'm kind of thinking the same system that they're, you know, that Ford's using on this particular deal now, but no, you can't.
There's a whole bunch of difference there. You're talking way back then and now. You're talking fluid differences, clutch differences, just all kinds of stuff. Transfer cases are improving every year. I mean, it's just the difference. I think what they want to create this vision that we need all four tires to be going the same RPM. And on a road, on a pavement road, we may have a problem with that because one of them has 7 pounds of more air than the other one or something stupid like that.
Right. And, I mean, back in, you're talking the 50s and the 60s, sure, you left it four-wheel drive and you get back on the asphalt and it starts squawking as you go in a tight turn because
exactly.
It's trying to keep all the systems locked together.
But they don't do that now.
No.
They don't do that now. There's no squawking when you turn right, a hard right or a hard left on a good road or on a slippery road. There's no more. The differentials are working like they're supposed to and a whole lot better than they did.
And nowadays on most what we call all-wheel drives where there is no, you can't select two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, they're all-wheel drive. Normally above 20 miles an hour, those systems are disconnected. Then you're just basically in, let's say you're in a all-wheel drive Honda Pilot. Once you get above 20 miles an hour, you're strictly 100% powered by the front wheels. Because above 20 miles an hour, you don't need that traction because you're already going.
We're
going
to use the axle that can power us through wherever it's at. And does the Honda Pilot, can it select front or rear?
Yes.
Okay, so if we start spinning the rear, it's going to send the power to the front and vice versa.
Right.
Okay.
Most all-wheel drive.
Yeah. I got to run because I'm being. Can you hear him using bad words at me? Gil is using bad words. He says you're 3 minutes past your break, and I said it's Harry's fault. It's Harry's fault. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. 46 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, Eddie and I are sitting here talking off air about all kinds of stuff. And we're talking about our differences in opinions with some of the cars and some of the trucks and some of the oils and some of the maintenance and stuff. You can have that kind of difference because we have different experiences. But the answer to Harry's issue is Ford doesn't want him on four-wheel drive on paved roads. And I'm suggesting that it's okay.
Right. I mean, but there is no need to have four-wheel drive on a paved road.
Right. But if you come off of a dirt road and you've got to drive 5 miles on a dirt road before you hit a pull off, you either do it before you get on the road, but you're unsure about the highway. I can see scenarios where somebody would get stuck and have to drive another mile to a turn off to turn off four wheel drive. But so let me just change the question: how many times have we seen a calamity happen because of something like that? Can you remember?
I can't either.
I can't remember ever having a four-wheel drive anything come in with a blown-up differential or a blown-up transfer case that wasn't obvious. I had one not so long ago up in Prescott, and the kid, well, he burned the right rear tire clearing down to nothing trying to get out of the hole he was in, and then all of a sudden all hell broke loose.
Yeah,
and there was a whole lot of pieces.
Those kind of repairs are self-inflicted.
And they're obvious. When they get off the tow truck, they're obvious. All right, this didn't happen by itself. There's somebody who was sitting right here in this seat is what caused this to happen. All righty. Anyway, I'm going to talk about three shops here in town that I'm really proud of. These guys are really, really good. But we're going to start with Mesa. The East Valley is very difficult for me to find shops that have tenure. Tenure is important to me. I need to know that the owner's been there for years and years and years. I need to know that the owner has a good relationship with parts houses, pays his bills, you know, stuff like that. And so I just don't have anybody that has applied over the last 3 or 4 years that had more check marks than they should. But Thompson's Auto Repair is different. Thompson's has been around since 1970. Brian and Thelma run Thompson's Auto Repair. They both come from families from the Shell and the Union 76.
The old gas stations.
The old gas stations. One of their parents ran Shell stations, and the other parent ran a Union 76. These kids have smelled gasoline their whole life. And they've seen Dad with grease and dirty fingernails at dinner a lot. So Brian and Thelma have a ASE certified technicians. They they really have the highest level of automotive services that I found in the East Valley. They do friendly reminders to let you know when your vehicle's due for service. So they do those kinds of things to help you keep your car in order. So Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing is on Main Street just east of Stapley in Mesa, and it's the only shop in the East Valley that I can really recommend. As far as diesels are concerned, Nate is strictly diesel up north. He's a big dog.
Yeah, he's very, very knowledgeable.
And Fords and Chevys and Dodges, all of them. And he's a nice guy, and he's one of the few owners that will take calls and talk to you about your car sometimes for a long time. And he's just a good guy about that. When you meet him, he's 9 feet tall, and his hands look like tennis rackets. So you don't want to make him mad, because if he hits you outside your head, you're going to find your head in a zip code that's two away. But he's the nicest guy in the world. And Strictly Diesel also has, if you want to do some performance modifications to your diesel engine and still stay within some parameters of reasonability, Nate's a good guy for that. So you can also go to his website. So Nate at Strictly Diesel, I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road, and the name of the shop is Strictly Diesel Service and Repair. And he's open Monday through Friday, but his website sells parts 24 hours a day. And then last but not least, we've got Larry Harker's Auto, and this is a shop that goes back to the 50s and the 60s. Bob was there. And Bob knows from the very beginning of carburetors to the very beginning of ignition systems and the points in the condensers, and then gone through to electronic ignition and then crank. Then we did away altogether with the distributor.
I think he invented the PCV valve.
He did. But he has just such a tremendous skill level with respect to, and I've traveled that path, but he's better than I am. He's just better than I am. He's been in the trenches longer, I think. I think I ended up, going into administration a little earlier than he did. But Larry Harker's has been around on 38th Avenue and Indian School since 1967. And the best story I have to tell is it was a BMW, and the person brought the BMW in and gave him an estimate that somebody had bid it for $1,700 worth of work because the passenger side floorboard was wet. And they found that the condensate tube from the evaporator was plugged, and it was running cold air conditioning water onto the mat on the passenger side of the floor. So all they did is hook a vacuum cleaner to the tube and suck the plug out of it, and then they just rinsed it out and fixed it all up and sent them on their way. They were up against a $1,700 bid. And they wanted to go in
and was it bid as a replace the heater core leaking?
And evaporator. It was a heater core and an evaporator. And those are in the same compartment.
Yes.
And so and your air conditioning system, the cold portion of your air conditioning system is called the evaporator, and the fan sits behind it, and the evaporator is very cold, like a big ice cube, and we blow air across the evaporator, which gives you cold air in your air conditioning. But it also sweats. And the water associated with that transformation is supposed to go out this tube. And everybody with a car knows that sometime in the summertime, you come out and there's water underneath.
There's going to be a puddle. Most of the time, it's on right behind the right front wheel.
Yep.
Sometimes it's in the middle of the car. But it's just water. You touch it with your finger. It's not greasy.
Yep.
You blow on it, and it evaporates. It's just water.
And it's cold, and it's clear.
Exactly. I was going to say, it's clear. It's not green.
It's not orange. It's not blue. It's just clear. And that's what it's supposed to do. But somebody had diagnosed this as we need to go in and do this. And the old cowboy says, you know what? I'm going to hook a vacuum cleaner to this thing and see if I can suck that big hairball out of that little bitty tube. And he did. And then he says, we even went in and we start putting some water into the vents because we knew the vents went to the evaporator case. And so we kind of rinsed it out, so to speak, and we gave it back to him. So the customer is real happy, and obviously that's the old cowboy, but that's exactly what Harker's is all about.
All right.
It's fundamentals are something they know as good as anybody.
But I'm glad you said that they used a vacuum cleaner, because there was a technician that worked here that the evaporator drain was plugged.
Uh-huh.
And he used a piece of a coat hanger to clear the tube out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that coat hanger was pretty stiff. He went up and he punctured one of the tubes on the evaporator.
Mm-hmm.
So now, instead of just having...
Now Mark fixes it.
Right. Just a water leak. Now we have to go in and replace the evaporator.
Right.
So if you're going to put something into the evaporator drain to try and unplug it. Use a zip tie, something flexible, something that's not as rigid as a coat hanger, that's not going to poke a hole in something.
And the evaporator is a small radiator-looking device. It looks just like a radiator. It might be aluminum, but it looks like a radiator. So it had fins, and it has air blowing across it, and it has tubes that go horizontal. It looks just like a small radiator, because its job is just like a radiator.
It's a heat exchanger.
It's a heat exchanger. So when you stick a coat hanger up there...
He popped the balloon.
Yeah. And you know, that's not the worst part, from my point of view. We've had cars fall off the hoist I had to pay for. We had cars that left the shop, and a block later,
the wheel came off.
We had the one lady who made it all the way to Rural Road with no oil.
Yes.
And
because the wrong oil filter was, they were placed on the bench, they were side by side, and the technician grabbed the oil filter he thought was for his car, but it wasn't. It threaded on, but it didn't seal.
And those are expenses of doing business. We put an engine in the lady's car.
Yes.
And we put an engine in, and the guy with the wheel fell off. We fixed his car. We no charged that ticket. We did a bunch. And the guy with the evaporator, we just said we messed up, and we're going to have to replace the evaporator, and this entire ticket's as no charge to you.
Correct.
Because you can't really charge him for what you should have done, although you're going to have to do that anyway. But I guess the message there is all shops are going to have these kinds of calamities.
Yes.
And there's as different calamities as there are technicians. And it's just one of those things. We had hoped that if you left our shop with no oil, which has only happened once that I can ever remember in 33 years you've worked for me, the light was on, the engine started clattering, then it started smoking, then it started knocking, and then it blew up. And I would kind of hope that you'd call me before that
started. It got to the very end.
But by the same token, by the time it starts smoking and screeching, it's over. Yeah. The motor's toast. And I mean, marks by a boner.
The biggest difference is how, when that happens, how does that person step up to the plate and say, raise his hand and say, it's on me, it's my fault.
2 minutes.
And the answer really is I'm going to put you back better than you came here. Because I can't put a 80,000 mile motor in your car. I'm going to have to do better than that. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to put you in a rental car, and you're going to have a warranty on the motor, even though I paid for it. You're going to have a warranty on the motor, and that's the best I can do. Or either that, or I'll buy your car. You know, and I think every time I've offered to buy their car, they don't want to buy.
On that one, I remember that, and the husband and the wife had the same. They both had a Toyota Avalon. Mm-hmm. He had one. She had one.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just in love with those cars, mm-hmm. and he didn't want to get rid of it.
Yep. So I said, okay, we'll put a motor
in it. I put an engine in it.
Oh, you just covered up for the technician that made that mistake?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say his name.
Okay. I didn't know if you were going to raise your hand and say it was you or not. But anyway, you can't process... I don't know. I don't even know the number. We process a lot of cars every year, and we make mistakes. The difference between us and some other people in our industry is we know that we made a mistake, and we're going to raise our hand and say we made a mistake. But if you're going to go to the Eagle or the Beaver, and that's the next thing out of your mouth, then you're not getting any cooperation from me, because I work for the Eagle, but I work for lawyers. I'm not scared of that kind of threat. Why don't you let me put you back better than you were, and then let's see what happens. So I'm not going to give you a car engine that's going to smoke. I'm not going to give you one that's been road hard and put away wet. I'm going to really do a good job as if you were my mother or my father. I'm going to give you back something better than we wrecked. So, but again, these major calamities, they're not once a year.
No, I mean, every car that comes in here has a work order number, and we're up to 130,000, I think, now. And this is... We used to handwrite them, so we have cars going back before that we've worked on.
Yeah. Well, we have 38,000 customers, yes, too. So, and then we're growing at sometimes 20 customers a month, so it's tough. All righty, we'll see you next week right here on KKNT.